to him that it was going to happen. I'd never done anything like that before, never even dreamed of it. But there was something in the way he looked at me, the way he smiled at me. We couldn't help ourselves. We did it there in the kitchen up against the counter. It was insane. But that's how we were. That's what he always used to say to me. Don't expect me to be sane, Anna. Not with you. I pick Evie up, and we go out into the garden together. She's pushing her little trolley up and down, giggling to herself as she does it, this morning's tantrum forgotten. Every time she grins at me, I feel like my heart's going to explode. No matter how much I miss working, I would miss this more. And in any case, it's never going to happen. There's no way I'll be leaving her with a childminder again, no matter how qualified or vouched for they are. I'm not leaving her with anyone else ever again, not after Megan. Evening. Tom texted me to say he was going to be a bit late this evening. He had to take a client out for a drink. Evie and I were getting ready for our evening walk. We were in the bedroom, Tom's and mine, and I was getting her changed. The light was just gorgeous, a rich orange glow filling the house, turning suddenly blue-grey when the sun went behind a cloud. I'd had the curtains pulled halfway across to stop the room getting too hot, so I went to open them. And that's when I saw Rachel, standing on the opposite side of the road, looking at our house. Then she just took off, walking back towards the station. I'm sitting on the bed, and I'm shaking with fury, digging my nails into my palms. Evie's kicking her feet in the air, and I'm so bloody angry I don't want to pick her up for fear I would crush her. He told me he'd sorted this out. He told me that he phoned her on Sunday, they talked, she admitted that she had struck up some sort of friendship with Scott Hipwell, but that she didn't intend seeing him any longer, that she wouldn't be hanging around any more. Tom said she promised him, and that he believed her. Tom said she was being reasonable, she didn't seem drunk, she wasn't hysterical, she didn't make threats or beg him to go back to her. He told me he thought she was getting better. I take a few deep breaths and pull Evie up onto my lap. I lie her back against my legs and hold her hands with mine. I think I've had enough of this, don't you, sweetie? It's just so wearing. Every time I think that things are getting better, that we're finally over the Rachel issue, there she is again. Sometimes I feel like she's never, ever going to go away. Deep inside me, a rotten seed has been planted. When Tom tells me it's okay, everything's all right, she's not going to bother us any longer, and then she does, I can't help wondering whether he's trying as hard as he can to get rid of her, or whether there's some part of him, deep down, that likes the fact that she can't let go. I go downstairs and scrabble around in the kitchen drawer for the card that Detective Sergeant Riley left. I dial her number quickly before I have time to change my mind. Wednesday the 14th of August, 2013. Morning. In bed, his hands on my hips, his breath hot against my neck, his skin slick with sweat against mine, he says, "We don't do this enough anymore." "I know. We need to make more time for ourselves." "We do." "I miss you," he says. "I miss this. I want more of this." I roll over and kiss him on the lips, my eyes tight shut, trying to suppress the guilt I feel for going to the police behind his back. "I think we should go somewhere," he mumbles. "Just the two of us. Get away for a bit." "And leave Evie with who, I want to ask? Your parents, whom you don't speak to? Or my mother, who is so frail she can barely care for herself?" I don't say that. I don't say anything. I just kiss him again, more deeply. His hand slips down to the back of my thigh, and he grips it hard. "What do you think? Where would you like to go? Mauritius? Bali?" I laugh. "I'm serious," he says, pulling back from me, looking me in the eye. We deserve it, Anna. You deserve it. It's been a hard year, hasn't it? But what? He flashes his perfect smile at me. We'll figure something out with Evie, don't worry. Tom, the money. We'll be okay. But I don't want to say this, but I have to. We don't have enough money to even consider moving house, but we do have enough money for a holiday in Mauritius or Bali. He puffs out his cheeks and exhales slowly, rolling away from me. I shouldn't have said it. The baby monitor crackles into life. Evie's waking up. I'll get her, he says, and gets up and leaves the room. At breakfast, Evie is doing her thing. It's a game to her now, refusing food, shaking her head, chin up, lips firmly closed, her little fists pushing at the bowl in front of her. Tom's patience wears thin quickly. I don't have time for this, he says to me. You'll have to do it. He gets to his feet, holding out the spoon for me to take, the expression on his face pained. I take a deep breath. It's okay. He's tired. He has a lot of work on. He's pissed off because I didn't enter into his holiday fantasy this morning. But it isn't okay, because I'm tired too, and I'd like to have a conversation about money and our situation here that doesn't end with him just walking out of the room. Of course I don't say that. Instead, I break my promise to myself, and I go ahead and mention Rachel. She's been hanging around again, I say. So whatever you said to her the other day didn't do the trick. He gives me a sharp look. What do you mean, hanging around? She was here last night, standing in the street right opposite the house. Was she with someone? No, she was alone. Why do you ask that? Fuck's sake, he says, and his face darkens the way it does when he's really angry. I told her to stay away. Why didn't you say anything last night? I didn't want to upset you, I say softly, already regretting bringing this up. I didn't want to worry you. Jesus, he says, and he dumps his coffee cup loudly in the sink. The noise gives Evie a fright and she starts to cry. This doesn't help. I don't know what to tell you. I honestly don't. When I spoke to her, she was fine. She listened to what I was saying and promised not to come around here any longer. She looked fine. She looked healthy, actually, back to normal. She looked fine, I ask him, and before he turns his back on me, I can see in his face that he knows he's been caught. I thought you said you spoke to her on the phone. He takes a deep breath, sighs heavily, then turns back to me, his face a blank. Yeah, well, that's what I told you, darling, because I knew you'd get upset if I saw her. So I hold my hands up. I lied. Anything for an easy life. Are you kidding me? He smiles at me, shaking his head as he steps towards me, his hands still raised up in supplication. I'm sorry, I'm sorry. She wanted to chat in person, and I thought it might be best. I'm sorry, okay? We just talked. We met in a crappy coffee shop in Ashbury and talked for 20 minutes, half an hour tops, okay? He puts his arms around me and pulls me towards his chest. I try to resist him, but he's stronger than me, and anyway he smells great, and I don't want a fight. I want us to be on the same side. I'm sorry, he mumbles again into my hair. It's all right, I say. I let him get away with it, because I'm dealing with this now. I spoke to Detective Sergeant Riley yesterday evening, and I knew the moment we started talking that I'd done the right thing by calling her. Because when I told her that I'd seen Rachel leaving Scott Hipwell's house on several occasions, a slight exaggeration, she seemed very interested. She wanted to know dates and times. I could furnish her with two. I was vague about the other incidents. If they'd had a relationship prior to Megan Hipwell's disappearance, whether I thought they were in a sexual relationship now. I have to say the thought hadn't really crossed my mind. I can't imagine him going from Megan to Rachel. In any case, his wife's barely cold in the ground. I went over the stuff about Evie as well, the attempted abduction, just in case she'd forgotten. She's very unstable, I said. You might think I'm overreacting, but I can't take any risks where my family is concerned. Not at all, she said. Thank you very much for contacting me. If you see anything else that you consider suspicious, let me know. I've no idea what they'll do about her. Perhaps just warn her off. It'll help, in any case, if we do start looking into things like restraining orders. Hopefully, for Tom's sake, it won't come to that. After Tom leaves for work, I take Evie to the park. We play on the swings and the little wooden rocking horses, and when I put her back into her buggy, she falls asleep almost immediately, which is my cue to go shopping. We cut through the back streets towards the big Sainsbury's. It's a bit of a roundabout way of getting there, but it's quiet with very little traffic, and in any case, we get to pass number 34 Cranham Street. It gives me a little frisson even now, walking past that house. Butterflies suddenly swarm in my stomach, and a smile comes to my lips and colour to my cheeks. I remember hurrying up the front steps, hoping none of the neighbours would see me letting myself in, getting myself ready in the bathroom, putting on perfume, the kind of underwear you put on just to be taken off. Then I'd get a text message, and he'd be at the door, and we'd have an hour or two in the bedroom upstairs. He'd tell Rachel he was with a client or meeting friends for a beer. "Aren't you worried she'll check up on you?" I'd ask him, and he'd shake his head, dismissing the idea. "I'm a good liar," he told me once with a grin. Once he said, "Even if she did check, the thing with Rachel is she won't remember what happened tomorrow anyway." That's when I started to realize just how bad things were for him. It wipes the smile off my face, though, thinking about those conversations. Thinking about Tom laughing conspiratorially while he traced his fingers lower over my belly, smiling up at me, saying, "I'm a good liar." He is a good liar. A natural. I've seen him doing it. Convincing check-in staff that we were honeymooners, for example. Or talking his way out of extra hours at work by claiming a family emergency. Everyone does it, of course they do. Only when Tom does it, you believe him. I think about breakfast this morning. But the point is that I caught him in the lie, and he admitted it straight away. I don't have anything to worry about. He isn't seeing Rachel behind my back. The idea is ridiculous. She might have been attractive once. She was quite striking when he met her. I've seen pictures, all huge dark eyes and generous curves. But now, she's just run to fat. And in any case, he would never go back to her, not after everything she did to him, to us. All the harassment, all those late-night phone calls, hang-ups, text messages. I'm standing in the tin goods aisle, Evie still mercifully sleeping in the buggy, and I start thinking about those phone calls, and about the time, or was it times, when I woke up and the bathroom light was on. I could hear his voice low and gentle behind the closed door. He was calming her down, I know he was. He told me that sometimes she'd be so angry she'd threaten to come round to the house, go to his work, throw herself in front of a train. He might be a very good liar, but I know when he's telling the truth. He doesn't fool me. Evening. Only thinking about it. He did fool me, didn't he? When he told me that he'd spoken to Rachel on the phone, that she sounded fine, better, happy almost, I didn't doubt him for a moment. And when he came home on Monday night, and I asked him about his day, and he talked to me about a really tiresome meeting that morning, I listened sympathetically, not once suspecting that there was no meeting, that all the while he was in a coffee shop in Ashbury with his ex-wife. This is what I'm thinking about while I'm unloading the dishwasher, with great care and precision, because Evie is napping, and the clatter of cutlery against crockery might wake her up. He does fool me. I know he's not always 100% honest about everything. I think about that story about his parents, how he invited them to the wedding, but they refused to come because they were so angry with him for leaving Rachel. I've always thought that was odd. Because on the two occasions when I've spoken to his mum, she sounded so pleased to be talking to me. She was kind, interested in me, in Evie. I do hope we'll be able to see her soon, she said. But when I told Tom about it, he dismissed it.
She's trying to get me to invite them round, he said, just so she can refuse. Power games.
She didn't sound like a woman playing power games to me, but I didn't press the point.
The workings of other people's families are always so impenetrable.
He'll have his reasons for keeping them at arm's length. I know he will, and they'll be centered on protecting me and Evie. So why am I wondering now whether that was true? It's this house, this situation, all the things that have been going on here. They're making me doubt myself, doubt us. If I'm not careful, they'll drive me crazy, and I'll end up like her, like Rachel.
I'm just sitting here, waiting to take the sheets out of the tumble dryer. I think about turning on the television and seeing if there's an episode of Friends on that I haven't watched 300 times. I think about doing my yoga stretches, and I think about the novel on my bedside table, which I've read 12 pages of in the past 2 weeks. I think about Tom's laptop, which is on the coffee table in the living room. And then I do the things I never thought I would. I grab the bottle of red which we opened last night with dinner, and I pour myself a glass. Then I fetch his laptop, power it up, and start trying to guess the password. I'm doing the things she did, drinking alone and snooping on him. The things she did and he hated. But recently as this morning, things have shifted. If he's going to lie, then I'm going to check up on him. That's a fair deal, isn't it? I feel I'm owed a bit of fairness. So I try to crack the password. I try names in different combinations, mine and his and Evie's, mine and Evie's, all three of us together, forwards and backwards. Our birthdays in various combinations, anniversaries, the first time we saw each other, the first time we had sex. Number 34, 4 Cranham Street. Number 23, this house. I try to think outside the box. Most men use football teams as passwords, I think, but Tom isn't into football. He quite likes cricket, so I try Boycott and Botham and Ashes. I don't know the names of any of the recent ones. I drain my glass and pour another half. I'm actually rather enjoying myself, trying to solve the puzzle. I think of bands he likes, films he enjoys, actresses he fancies. I type password. I type 1234. There's an awful screeching outside as the London train stops at the signal, like nails on a chalkboard. I clench my teeth and take another long swig of wine, and as I do, I notice the time. Jesus, it's almost 7, and Evie's still sleeping, and he'll be home in a minute. And I'm literally thinking that he'll be home in a minute when I hear the rattle of the key in the door and my heart stops. I snap the laptop shut and jump to my feet, knocking my chair over with a clatter. Evie wakes and starts to cry. I put the computer back on the table before he gets into the room, but he knows something's up, and he just stares at me and says, "What's going on?" I tell him, "Nothing. Nothing. I knocked over a chair by mistake." He picks Evie up out of her pram to give her a cuddle, and I catch sight of myself in the hallway mirror, my face pale and my lips stained dark red with wine.
Rachel. Thursday the 15th of August, 2013. Morning. Kathy has got me a job interview. A friend of hers has set up her own public relations firm, and she needs an assistant. It's basically a glorified secretarial job, and it pays next to nothing. But I don't care. This woman is prepared to see me without references. Kathy's told her some story about me having a breakdown, but being fully recovered now. The interview's tomorrow afternoon, at this woman's home. She runs her business from one of those office sheds in the back garden, which just happens to be in Whitney. So I was supposed to be spending the day polishing up my CV and my interviewing skills. I was. Only Scott phoned me.
"I was hoping we could talk," he said.
"You don't need to say anything. We both know it was a mistake."
"I know," he said.
and he sounded so sad. Not like the angry Scott of my nightmares. More the broken one that sat on my bed and told me about his dead child.
But I really want to talk to you.
Of course, I said. Of course we can talk.
In person?
Oh, I said. The last thing I wanted was to have to go back to that house. I'm sorry, I can't today.
Please, Rachel. It's important.
He sounded desperate, and, despite myself, I felt bad for him. I was trying to think of an excuse when he said it again.
Please?
So I said yes, and I regretted it the second the word came out of my mouth. There's a story about Megan's child, her first dead child, in the newspapers. Well, it's about the child's father, actually. They tracked him down. His name's Craig McKenzie, and he died of a heroin overdose in Spain 4 years ago. So that rules him out. It never sounded to me like a likely motive in any case. If someone wanted to punish her for what she'd done back then, they'd have done it years ago. So who does that leave? It leaves the usual suspects. The husband, the lover, Scott, Kamal. Or some random man who snatched her from the street, a serial killer just starting out. Will she be the first of a series? A Wilma McCann? A Pauline Reed? And who said, after all, that the killer had to be a man? She was a small woman, Megan Hipwell. Tiny, bird-like. It wouldn't take much force to take her down. Afternoon. The first thing I notice when he opens the door is the smell. Sweat and beer, rank and sour, and under that something else. Something worse. Something rotting. He's wearing tracksuit bottoms and a stained grey t-shirt. His hair is greasy, his skin slick, as though with fever. "Are you all right?" I ask him, and he grins at me. He's been drinking.
"I'm fine, come in. Come in."
I don't want to, but I do. The curtains on the street side of the house are closed, and the living room is cast in a reddish hue which seems to suit the heat and the smell. Scott wanders into the kitchen, opens the fridge and takes a beer out.
"Come and sit down," he says. "Have a drink."
The grin on his face is fixed, joyless, grim. There's something unkind about the set of his face. The contempt that I saw on Saturday morning, after we slept together. It's still there. "I can't stay long," I tell him. "I have a job interview tomorrow. I need to prepare."
"Really?"
He raises his eyebrows. He sits down and kicks a chair out towards me.
"Sit down and have a drink,"
he says. An order, not an invitation. I sit down opposite him, and he pushes the beer bottle towards me. I pick it up and take a sip. Outside, I can hear shrieking, children playing in a back garden somewhere. And beyond that, the faint and familiar rumble of the train.
"They got the DNA results yesterday," Scott says to me. "Detective Sergeant Riley came to see me last night."
He waits for me to say something, but I'm frightened of saying the wrong thing, so I stay silent.
"It's not mine." "It wasn't mine. The funny thing is, it wasn't Kamal's either."
He laughs.
"So she had someone else on the go. Can you believe it?"
He's smiling that horrible smile.
"You didn't know anything about that, did you? About another bloke? She didn't confide in you about another man, did she?"
The smile is slipping from his face, and I'm getting a bad feeling about this. A very bad feeling. I get to my feet and take a step towards the door, but he's there in front of me, his hands gripping my arms, and he pushes me back into the chair.
"Sit the fuck down!"
He grabs my handbag from my shoulder and throws it into the corner of the room. "Scott, I don't know what's going on.
Come on!"
he shouts, leaning over me.
"You and Megan were such good friends. You must have known about all her lovers."
He knows, and as the thought comes to me, he must see it in my face because he leans in closer, his breath rancid in my face, and says,
"Come on, Rachel. Tell me.
I shake my head, and he swings a hand out, catching the beer bottle in front of me. It rolls off the table and smashes on the tiled floor.
You never even fucking met her,
he yells.
Everything you said to me, everything was a lie.
Ducking my head, I get to my feet, mumbling.
I'm sorry, I'm sorry.
I'm trying to get round the table, to retrieve my handbag, my phone, but he grabs my arm again.
Why did you do this?
He asks.
What made you do this? What is wrong with you?
He's looking at me, his eyes locked on mine, and I'm terrified of him. But at the same time, I know that his question isn't unreasonable. I owe him an explanation. So I don't pull my arm away. I let his fingers dig into my flesh, and I try to speak clearly and calmly. I try not to cry. I try not to panic. I wanted you to know about Kamal, I tell him. I saw them together, like I told you. But you wouldn't have taken me seriously if I'd just been some girl on the train. I needed...
You needed!
He lets go of me, turning away.
You're telling me what you needed.
His voice is softer. He's calming down. I breathe deeply, trying to slow my heart.
I wanted to help you, I say. I knew that the police always suspect the husband, and I wanted you to know there was someone else. So you made up a story about knowing my wife. Do you have any idea how insane you sound?
I do. I walk over to the kitchen counter to pick up a dishcloth, then get down on my hands and knees and clean up the spilled beer. Scott sits, elbows on knees, head hanging down.
She wasn't who I thought she was, he says. I have no idea who she was.
I wring the cloth out over the sink and run cold water over my hands. My handbag is a couple of feet away, in the corner of the room. I make a move towards it, but Scott looks up at me, so I stop. I stand there, my back to the counter, my hands gripping the edge for stability. For comfort.
Detective Sergeant Riley told me,
he says.
She was asking me about you. Whether I was in a relationship with you.
He laughs.
A relationship with you? Jesus! I asked her, have you seen what my wife looked like? Standards haven't fallen that fast.
My face is hot. There is cold sweat under my armpits and at the base of my spine.
Apparently Anna's been complaining about you. She's seen you hanging around. So that's how it all came out. I said we're not in a relationship. She's just an old friend of Megan's. She's helping me out.
He laughs again, low and mirthless.
She said she doesn't know Megan. She's just a sad little liar with no life.
The smile faded from his face.
You're all liars. Every last one of you.
My phone beeps. I take a step towards the bag, but Scott gets there before me.
Hang on a minute,
he says, picking it up.
We're not finished yet.
He tips the contents of my handbag onto the table. Phone, purse, keys, lipstick, Tampax, credit card receipts.
I want to know exactly how much of what you told me was total bullshit.
Idly, he picks up the phone and looks at the screen. He raises his eyes to mine, and they are suddenly cold. He reads aloud.
This is to confirm your appointment with Dr. Abditch at 4:30 p.m. on Monday the 19th of August. If you are unable to make this appointment, please be advised that we require 24 hours' notice.
Scott?
What the hell is going on?
He asks, his voice little more than a rasp.
What have you been doing? What have you been saying to him?
I haven't been saying anything. He's dropped the phone on the table and is coming towards me, his hands balled into fists. I'm backing away into the corner of the room, pressing myself between the wall and the glass door.
I was trying to find out. I was trying to help.
He raises his hand and I cringe, ducking my head, waiting for the pain. And in that moment, I know that I've done this before. Felt this before. But I can't remember when, and I don't have time to think about it now because, although he hasn't hit me,
He's placed his hands on my shoulders, and he's gripping them tightly. His thumbs digging into my clavicles, and it hurts so much I cry out. All this time, he says through gritted teeth. All this time, I thought you were on my side, and you were working against me. You were giving him information, weren't you? Telling him things about me, about Meg's. It was you, trying to make the police come after me. It was you.
No, please don't. It wasn't like that. I wanted to help you.
His right hand slides up. He grabs hold of my hair at the nape of my neck and he twists.
Scott, please don't. Please. You're hurting me. Please.
He's dragging me now, towards the front door. I'm flooded with relief. He's going to throw me out into the street. Thank God. Only he doesn't throw me out. He keeps dragging me, spitting and cursing. He's taking me upstairs, and I'm trying to resist, but he's so strong, I can't. I'm crying, please don't, please. And I know that something terrible is about to happen. I try to scream, but I can't. The noise won't come. I'm blind with tears and terror. He shoves me into a room and slams the door behind me. The key twists in the lock. Hot bile rises to my throat and I throw up onto the carpet. I wait. I listen. Nothing happens. And no one comes. I'm in the spare room. In my house, this room used to be Tom's study. Now it's their baby's nursery. The room with the soft pink blind. Here, it's a box room, filled with papers and files. A fold-up treadmill and an ancient Apple Mac. There is a box of papers lined with figures, accounts, perhaps from Scott's business, and another, filled with old postcards, blank ones with bits of blue tack on the back, as though they were once stuck to a wall. The roofs of Paris, children skateboarding in an alley, old railway sleepers covered in moss, a view of the sea from inside a cave. I delve through the postcards. I don't know why or what I'm looking for. I'm just trying to keep panic at bay. I'm trying not to think about that news report. Megan's body being dragged out of the mud. I'm trying not to think of her injuries, of how frightened she must have been when she saw it coming. I'm scrabbling around in the postcards, and then something bites me, and I rock back on my heels with a yelp. The tip of my forefinger is sliced neatly across the top, and blood is dripping onto my jeans. I stop the blood with the hem of my t-shirt and sort more carefully through the cards. I spot the culprit immediately. A framed picture, smashed, with a piece of glass missing from the top. The exposed edge smeared with my blood. It's not a photo I've seen before. It's a picture of Megan and Scott together, their faces close to the camera. She's laughing and he's looking at her adoringly. Jealously? The glass is shattered in a star, radiating from the corner of Scott's eye, so it's difficult to read his expression. I sit there on the floor with the picture in front of me, and think about how things get broken all the time by accident, and how sometimes you just don't get round to getting them fixed. I think about all the plates that were smashed when I fought with Tom, about that hole in the plaster in the corridor upstairs. Somewhere, on the other side of the locked door, I can hear Scott laughing, and my entire body goes cold. I scrabble to my feet and go to the window, open it and lean right out. Then with just the very tips of my toes on the floor, I cry out for help. I call out for Tom. It's hopeless, pathetic. Even if he was, by some chance, out in the garden a few doors down, he wouldn't hear me. It's too far away. I look down and lose my balance, then pull myself back inside. Bowels loosening, sobs catching in my throat.
Please, Scott!
I call out.
Please!
I hate the sound of my voice, the wheedling note, the desperation. I look down at my blood-stained t-shirt, and I'm reminded that I am not without options. I pick up the photo frame and tip it over onto the carpet. I select the longest of the glass shards and slip it carefully into my back pocket. I can hear footsteps coming up the stairs. I back myself up against the wall opposite the door. The key turns in the lock. Scott has my handbag in one hand and tosses it at my feet. In the other hand, he is holding a scrap of paper.
"Well, if it isn't Nancy Drew," he says with a smile.
He puts on a girly voice and reads aloud. "Megan has run off with her boyfriend, who from here on in I shall refer to as B." He snickers.
"B has harmed her. Scott has harmed her."
He crumples up the paper and throws it at my feet.
"Jesus Christ, you really are pathetic, aren't you?"
He looks around, taking in the puke on the floor, the blood on my T-shirt.
"Fucking hell. What have you been doing? Trying to top yourself? Going to do my job for me?"
He laughs again.
"I should break your fucking neck, but you know what? You're just not worth the hassle."
He stands to one side.
"Get out of my house!"
I grab my bag and make for the door. But just as I do, he steps out in front of me with a boxer's feint. And for a moment, I think he's going to stop me, put his hands on me again. There must be terror in my eyes because he starts to laugh. He roars with laughter. I can still hear him when I slam the front door behind me. Friday the 16th of August, 2013. Morning. I've barely slept. I drank a bottle and a half of wine in an attempt to get off to sleep. To stop my hands shaking. To quieten my startle reflex. But it didn't really work. Every time I started to drop off, I'd jolt awake. I felt sure I could feel him in the room with me. I turned the light on and sat there, listening to the sounds of the street outside, the people moving around in the building. It was only when it started to get light that I relaxed enough to sleep. I dreamed I was in the woods again. Tom was with me, but still I felt afraid. I left Tom a note last night. After I left Scott's, I ran down to number 23 and banged on the door. I was in such a panic, I didn't even care whether Anna was there, whether she'd be pissed off with me for showing up. No one came to the door, so I scribbled a note on a scrap of paper and shoved it through the letterbox. I don't care if she sees it. I think a part of me actually wants her to see it. I kept the note vague. I told him we needed to talk about the other day. I didn't mention Scott by name because I didn't want Tom to go round there and confront him. God knows what might happen. I rang the police almost as soon as I got home. I had a couple of glasses of wine first to calm me down. I asked to speak to Detective Inspector Gaskill, but they said he wasn't available, so I ended up talking to Riley. It wasn't what I wanted. I know Gaskill would have been kinder. "He imprisoned me in his home," I told her. "He threatened me." She asked how long I was imprisoned for. I could hear the air quotes over the line. "I don't know," I said. "Half an hour, maybe?" There was a long silence.
"And he threatened you. Can you tell me the exact nature of the threat?"
"He said he'd break my neck. He said he ought to break my neck."
"He ought to break your neck?"
"He said that he would if he could be bothered."
Silence, then.
"Did he hit you? Did he injure you in any way?"
"Bruising, just bruising."
"He hit you?"
"No, he grabbed me."
More silence. Then,
"Miss Watson, why were you in Scott Hipwell's house?"
"He asked me to go to see him. He said he needed to talk to me."
She gave a long sigh.
"You were warned to stay out of this. You've been lying to him, telling him you were a friend of his wife's. You've been telling all sorts of stories and, let me finish, this is a person who, at best, is under a great deal of strain and is extremely distressed. At best. At worst, he might be dangerous."
"He is dangerous. That's what I'm telling you, for God's sake."
"This is not helpful. You going round there lying to him, provoking him. We're in the middle of a murder investigation here. You need to understand that. You could jeopardise our progress. You could..."
"What progress?"
I snapped.
"You haven't made any bloody progress. He killed his wife, I'm telling you. There's a picture, a photograph of the two of them. It's smashed. He's angry. He's unstable."
"Yes, we saw the photograph. The house has been searched. It's hardly evidence of murder."
"So you're not going to arrest him?"
She gave a long sigh. "Come to the station tomorrow.
Make a statement. We'll take it from there. And Miss Watson, stay away from Scott Hipwell.
Kathy came home and found me drinking. She wasn't happy. What could I tell her? There was no way to explain it. I just said I was sorry and went upstairs to my room, like a teenager in a sulk. And then I lay awake, trying to sleep, waiting for Tom to call. He didn't. I wake early, check my phone, no calls. Wash my hair and dress for my interview, hands trembling, stomach in knots. I'm leaving early because I have to stop off at the police station first, to give them my statement. Not that I'm expecting it to do any good. They never took me seriously, and they certainly aren't going to start now. I wonder what it would take for them to see me as anything other than a fantasist. On the way to the station, I can't stop looking over my shoulder. The sudden scream of a police siren has me literally leaping into the air in fright. On the station platform, I walk as close to the railings as I can, my fingers trailing against the iron fence, just in case I need to hold on tight. I realise it's ridiculous, but I feel so horribly vulnerable now that I've seen what he is, now that there are no secrets between us. Afternoon. The matter should be closed for me now. All this time, I've been thinking that there was something to remember, something I was missing. But there isn't. I didn't see anything important or do anything terrible. I just happened to be on the same street. I know this now, courtesy of the red-haired man. And yet there's an itch at the back of my brain that I just can't scratch. Neither Gaskill nor Riley was at the police station. I gave my statement to a bored-looking uniformed officer. It will be filed and forgotten about, I assume, unless I turn up dead in a ditch somewhere. My interview was on the opposite side of town to where Scott lives, but I took a taxi from the police station. I'm not taking any chances. It went as well as it could. The job itself is utterly beneath me, but then I seem to have become beneath me over the past year or two. I need to reset the scale. The big drawback, other than the crappy pay and the lowliness of the job itself, will be having to come to Whitney all the time. To walk these streets and risk running into Scott, or Anna and her child. Because bumping into people is all I seem to do in this neck of the woods. It's one of the things I used to like about the place, the village on the edge of London feel. You might not know everyone, but faces are familiar. I'm almost at the station, just passing the Crown, when I feel a hand on my arm, and I wheel around, slipping off the pavement and into the road.
Hey, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
It's him again, the red-haired man, pint in one hand, the other raised in supplication.
You're jumpy, aren't you?
He grins. I must look really frightened, because the grin fades.
Are you all right? I didn't mean to scare you.
He's knocked off early, he says, and invites me to have a drink with him. I say no, and then I change my mind. I owe you an apology, I say, when he, Andy, as it turns out, brings me my gin and tonic. For the way I behaved on the train, last time I mean, I was having a bad day.
It's all right,
Andy says. His smile is slow and lazy. I don't think this is his first pint. We're sitting opposite each other in the beer garden at the back of the pub. It feels safer here than on the street side. Perhaps it's the safe feeling that emboldens me. I take my chance. I wanted to ask you about what happened, I say, the night that I met you. The night that woman disappeared.
Oh, right. Why? What do you mean?
I take a deep breath. I can feel my face reddening. No matter how many times you have to admit this, it's always embarrassing. It always makes you cringe. I was very drunk, and I don't remember. There are some things I need to sort out. I just want to know if you saw anything, if you saw me talking to anyone else, anything like that. I'm staring down at the table. I can't meet his eye. He nudges my foot with his.
It's all right. You didn't do anything bad.
I look up and he's smiling.
I was pissed too. We had a bit of a chat on the train. I can't remember what about. Then we both got off here at Whitney, and you were a bit unsteady on your feet. You slipped on the steps. You remember? I helped you up, and you were all embarrassed, blushing like you are now.
He laughs.
We walked out together, and I asked you if you wanted to go to the pub, but you said you had to go and meet your husband.
That's it.
No. Do you really not remember? It was a while later, I don't know, half an hour maybe. I'd been to the Crown, but a mate rang and said he was drinking in a bar over the other side of the railway track, so I was heading down to the underpass. You'd fallen over. You were in a bit of a mess then. You'd cut yourself. I was a bit worried. I said I'd see you home if you wanted, but you wouldn't hear of it. You were... well, you were very upset. I think there'd been a row with your bloke. He was heading off down the street, and I said I'd go after him, if he wanted me to, but you said not to. He drove off somewhere after that. He was with someone.
A woman. He nods, ducks his head a bit.
Yeah, they got into a car together. I assumed that was what the argument was about.
And then?
Then you walked off. You seemed a little confused or something, and you walked off. You kept saying you didn't need any help. As I said, I was a bit wasted myself, so I just left it. I went down through the underpass and met my mate in the pub. That was it.
Climbing the stairs to the apartment, I feel sure that I can see shadows above me. Hear footsteps ahead. Someone waiting on the landing above. There's no one there, of course, and the flat is empty too. It feels untouched. It smells empty. But that doesn't stop me checking every room. Under my bed, and under Kathy's, in the wardrobes, and the closet in the kitchen that couldn't conceal a child. Finally, after about 3 tours of the flat, I can stop. I go upstairs and sit on the bed, and think about the conversation I had with Andy. The fact that it tallies with what I remember. There is no great revelation. Tom and I argued in the street. I slipped and hurt myself. He stormed off and got into his car with Anna. Later he came back looking for me, but I'd already gone. I got into a taxi, I assume, or back onto the train. I sit on my bed, looking out of the window, and wonder why I don't feel better. Perhaps it's simply because I still don't have any answers. Perhaps it's because, although what I remember tallies with what other people remember, something still feels off. And it strikes me. Anna. It's not just that Tom never mentioned going anywhere in the car with her. It's the fact that when I saw her walking away, getting into the car, she wasn't carrying the baby. Where was Evie while all this was going on? Saturday, the 17th of August, 2013. Evening. I need to speak to Tom, to get things straight in my head, because the more I go over it, the less sense it makes, and I can't stop going over it. I'm worried, in any case, because it's 2 days since I left him that note, and he hasn't got back to me. He didn't answer his phone last night. He's not been answering it all day. Something's not right, and I can't shake the feeling that it has to do with Anna. I know that he'll want to talk to me, too. After he hears about what happened with Scott, I know that he'll want to help. I can't stop thinking about the way he was that day in the car, about how things felt between us. So, I pick up the phone and dial his number. Butterflies in my stomach, just the way it always used to be. The anticipation of hearing his voice as acute now as it was years ago.
Yeah?
Tom, it's me.
Yes?
Anna must be there with him. He doesn't want to say my name. I wait for a moment to give him time to move to another room, to get away from her. I hear him sigh.
What is it?
I wanted to talk to you. As I said in my note, I...
What?
He sounds irritated. I left you a note a couple of days ago. I thought we should talk.
I didn't get a note.
Another heavier sigh.
Fuck's sake. That's why she's pissed off with me.
Anna must have taken it. She didn't give it to him.
What do you need?
I want to hang up, dial again, Start over. Tell him how good it was to see him on Monday, when we went to the lake. I just wanted to ask you something.
What?
He snaps. He sounds really annoyed. Is everything okay?
What do you want, Rachel?
It's gone. All the tenderness that was there a week ago. I curse myself for leaving that note. I've obviously got him into trouble at home. I wanted to ask you about that night. The night Megan Hipwell went missing.
Oh, Jesus. We've talked about this. You can't have forgotten already.
I just...
You were drunk,
he says, his voice loud, harsh.
I told you to go home. You wouldn't listen. You wandered off. I drove around looking for you, but I couldn't find you.
Where was Anna?
She was at home.
With the baby?
With Evie, yes.
She wasn't in the car with you?
No, but... Oh, for God's sake! She was supposed to be going out. I was going to babysit. Then you came along, so she came and cancelled her plans. And I wasted yet more hours of my life running around after you.
I wish I hadn't called. To have my hopes raised and dashed again. It's like cold steel twisting in my gut. Okay, I say. It's just, I remember it differently. Tom, when you saw me, was I hurt? Did I have a cut on my head? Another heavy sigh.
I'm surprised you remember anything at all, Rachel. You were blind drunk. Filthy, stinking drunk. Staggering all over the place.
My throat starts to close up, hearing him say these words. I've heard him say these sorts of things before. In the bad old days. The very worst days. When he was tired of me, sick of me, disgusted by me. Wearily, he goes on.
You'd fallen over in the street. You were crying. You were a total mess. Why is this important?
I can't find the words right away. I take too long to answer. He goes on.
Look, I have to go. Don't call any more, please. We've been through this. How many times do I have to ask you? Don't call. Don't leave notes. Don't come here. It upsets Anna. All right?
The phone goes dead. Sunday, the 18th of August, 2013. Early morning. I've been downstairs in the living room all night, with the television on for company. Fear ebbing and flowing. Strength ebbing and flowing. It feels a bit like I've gone back in time. The wound he made years ago ripped open again, new and fresh. It's silly, I know. I was an idiot to think that I had a chance with him again. Just on the basis of one conversation. A few moments which I took for tenderness, and which were probably nothing more than sentimentality and guilt. Still, it hurts, and I've just got to let myself feel the pain, because if I don't, if I keep numbing it, it'll never really go away. And I was an idiot to let myself think that there was a connection between me and Scott, that I could help him. So, I'm an idiot. I'm used to that. I don't have to continue to be one, do I? Not any longer. I lay here all night, and I promise myself that I'll get a handle on things. I'll move away from here, far away. I'll get a new job. I'll go back to my maiden name, sever ties with Tom, make it harder for anyone to find me, should anyone come looking. I haven't had much sleep. Lying here on the sofa, making plans. Every time I started drifting off to sleep, I heard Tom's voice in my head, as clear as if he were right there, right next to me, his lips against my ear. You are blind drunk, filthy, stinking drunk. And I jolted awake, shame washing over me like a wave. Shame, but also the strongest sense of déjà vu, because I've heard those words before, those exact words. And then I couldn't stop running the scenes through my head, waking with blood on the pillow, the inside of my mouth hurting as though I'd bitten my cheek. Fingernails dirty, terrible head. Tom coming out of the bathroom, that expression he wore, half hurt, half angry. Dread rising in me like floodwater. What happened? Tom showing me the bruises on his arm, on his chest where I'd hit him.
I don't believe it, Tom. I'd never hit you. I've never hit anyone in my life.
You were blind drunk, Rachel. Do you remember anything you did last night? Anything you said?
and then he'd tell me. And I still couldn't believe it because nothing he said sounded like me, none of it. And the thing with the golf club, that hole in the plaster, grey and blank like a blinded eye trained on me every time I passed it. And I couldn't reconcile the violence that he talked about with the fear that I remembered, or thought that I remembered. After a while, I learned not to ask what I had done, or to argue when he volunteered the information, because I didn't want to know the details. I didn't want to hear the worst of it, the things I said and did, when I was like that. Filthy, stinking drunk. Sometimes he threatened to record me. He told me he'd play it back for me. He never did. Small mercies. After a while, I learned that when you wake up like that, you don't ask what happened. You just say that you're sorry. You're sorry for what you did, and who you are. And you're never ever going to behave like that again. And now I'm not. I'm really not. I can be thankful to Scott for this. I'm too afraid now to go out in the middle of the night to buy booze. I'm too afraid to let myself slip, because that's when I make myself vulnerable. I'm going to have to be strong. That's all there is to it. My eyelids start to feel heavy again, and my head nods against my chest. I turn the TV down so there's almost no sound at all, roll over so that I'm facing the sofa back, snuggle down, and pull the duvet over me. And I'm drifting off. I can feel it. I'm going to sleep, and then... bang! The ground is rushing up at me, and I jerk upright, my heart in my throat. I saw it. I saw it. I was in the underpass, and he was coming towards me. One slap across the mouth, and then his fist raised, keys in his hand. Searing pain as the serrated metal smashed down against my skull.
Anna. Saturday, the 17th of August, 2013. Evening. I hate myself for crying. It's so pathetic. But I feel exhausted. These past few weeks have been so hard on me. And Tom and I have had another row about, inevitably, Rachel. It's been brewing, I suppose. I've been torturing myself about the note, about the fact that he lied to me about them meeting up. I keep telling myself it's completely stupid, but I can't fight the feeling that there is something going on between them. I've been going round and round after everything she did to him, to us. How could he? How could he even contemplate being with her again? I mean, if you look at the two of us side by side, there isn't a man on earth who would pick her over me. And that's without even going into all her issues. But then I think, this happens sometimes, doesn't it? People you have a history with, they won't let you go, and as hard as you might try, you can't disentangle yourself, can't set yourself free. Maybe, after a while, you just stop trying. She came by on Thursday, banging on the door and calling out for Tom. I was furious, but I didn't dare open up. Having a child with you makes you vulnerable. It makes you weak. If I'd been on my own, I would have confronted her. I'd have had no problems sorting her out. But with Evie here, I just couldn't risk it. I've no idea what she might do. I know why she came. She was pissed off that I'd talked to the police about her. I bet she came crying to Tom to tell me to leave her alone. She left a note. We need to talk. Please call me as soon as possible. It's important. Important underlined 3 times, which I threw straight into the bin. Later, I fished it out and put it in my bedside drawer, along with the printout of that vicious email she sent, and the log I've been keeping of all the calls and all the sightings. The harassment log. My evidence, should I need it. I called Detective Sergeant Riley and left a message saying that Rachel had been round again. She still hasn't rung back. I should have mentioned the note to Tom. I know I should have. But I didn't want him to get annoyed with me about talking to the police. So I just shoved it in that drawer and hoped that she'd forget about it. She didn't, of course. She rang him tonight. He was fuming when he got off the phone with her. What the f-